Today on the expanded one-hour WGXC evening news that's morphing into a news show called All Together Now next week, we hear from local grower Chris Cashin from the farm at Miller's Crossing talking about current weather conditions and how that's affecting growing with Kiernan Riley from April 25th on the WGXC afternoon show. We also hear from Karen Loeffler with the Valencia Volunteer Rescue Squad about how one can become a volunteer firefighter. That's from Something to Talk About, April 27th on WGXC. We also hear radio news on the Charter Time Warner merger. And the song of the day is from Tashi Dorji, who will perform April 30th at the Spotty Dog Books and Ale in Hudson. Stay tuned for reports from Philip Grant, Alana Medlock, and myself, Tom Rowe, and others on the WGXC Evening News.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
Radio broadcast, This I Believe.
Tune in to All Together Now, WGXC's collaborative hour-long news show at 6 p.m. featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Tune in to learn more about the issues that affect communities throughout the Capital Region and the Hudson Valley, from the Catskills to the Berkshires. From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for Wednesday, April 27, 2016. I'm Philip Grant. At the top of the news, Katie Kosajowski is reporting in the Daily Mail that U.S. Representative Chris Gibson has introduced legislation to address some of the issues related to the federal disaster assistance process. If passed, Gibson said the legislation would create a process for disaster assistance applicants to receive notice of what financial help they are eligible for and what the impact would be for accepting or declining certain types of aid. Applicants would also be told if they are entitled to receive additional forms of assistance and what the repayment requirements or penalties might be. Gibson said more residents were not aware of the complex rules that govern disaster assistance when they applied for help in the aftermath of Tropical Storm Irene and Superstorm Sandy. He said, and I quote, "This constituent-driven bill brings fairness and clarity to a system that's vital to rebuilding our communities," end quote. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail. Julia Reichel is reporting at the Watershed Post that a fire started by a man in the Ulster County town of Shandaken on Monday, April the 25th, burned 5 acres of forest on the south face of Garfield Mountain in the Catskill Forest Preserve. Within 20 minutes of being set, the blaze was out of control, according to a press release from the Shandaken Police. The man has been charged with negligently starting a forest fire, a state environmental violation. 20 local fire companies and police agencies worked for 6 hours before getting it under control. Shandaken is one of New York State's designated fire towns, where burning is heavily regulated throughout the year because of the high risk of sparking forest fires. You can read that full story in the Watershed Post. Brian Nearing is reporting at Capital Confidential that the State Department of Environmental Conservation is charging the operators of a 538-foot ship from the Marshall Islands with dumping oil in the Hudson River at Rensselaer on Friday, April the 22nd, Earth Day. The south wind transports scrap metal around the world. The ship's captain told DEC environmental conservation officers that the spill was caused by a backup of pressure in the ship's waste oil tanks. Crew members collected the spilled oil, and at least 20 gallons was discharged directly into the river. The captain and the owner of the ship were issued violations, including failure to contain waste oil, unlawful disposure of used oil, and failure to report an oil spill. The oil dissipated before the spill's response team could contain it. According to the DEC, the oil dump had a minimal environmental impact. The incident remains under investigation. You can read that full story at Capital Confidential. Yacy Roy in Newsday is reporting that State Attorney General Eric T. Schneiderman okayed online voter registration in Suffolk County. Long Island County would be the first in the state to allow online voter registration. Assistant Solicitor General Kathleen Sheingold wrote in the opinion that state election law would allow an electronic signature on a voter registration form. Schneiderman said the opinion opened, and I quote, a new era of truly online voter registration, an incredibly exciting step that will help make the state election process more accessible and simpler for all, end quote. You can read that full story in Newsday. Timothy Knight in the Watershed Post reports that former State Assembly Minority Leader John Fasco, who is running for the Republican nomination for New York's 19th Congressional District, was also a lobbyist for the Constitutional Pipeline since serving in Albany. The Constitutional Pipeline, one of four proposed to crisscross the area, was denied permits by the state's Department of Environmental Conservation on April 22nd. The pipeline would have run from northern Pennsylvania to Schoharie County, largely along I-88. Fasco, who is based in Kinderhook, defended the natural gas that would flow through the pipelines. Fasco said, and I quote, the reason New York State has had an almost 25% decline in carbon dioxide is because we replaced coal with natural gas, end quote. Millbrook Oil executive Andrew Haney and Hamden businessman Robert Bishop are running against Fasco in a June 28th primary election. You can read the full interview with Fasco in the Watershed Post. The Daily Freeman reports that rain on April 26 dampened a wildfire at Sam's Point in the Minnewaska State Park Preserve, but it was still active in the afternoon and has now burned an estimated 2,000 acres. Christopher Tarantino, public information officer for the state incident management team, said that the brush fire would likely burn throughout the night despite rainfall. He also worries about the dry forecast for the rest of the week. Flames have risen as high as 80 feet, and Governor Andrew Cuomo's office sent 70 more firefighters to the scene on April 26. You can read that full story in the Daily Freeman.
This is Tom Rue for WGXC with the local weather. Thursday morning, the low should be around 32, and Thursday should be mostly sunny with a high near 58, with a slight chance of showers after 2 a.m. Thursday night and into Friday, which should be partly sunny with a high near 56 and a low around 37. You're listening to 90.7 WGXC Acra.
You are listening to the WGXC News Update. I'm Alana Medlock. Vincent Manganelli in the Daily Mail reports that the Greene County Industrial Development Agency does use competitive bidding procedures, as a recent State Authorities Budget Office report recommends. A study by the State Authorities Budget Office released earlier in the month found municipal industrial development agencies that employ competitive bidding procedures when selecting service contracts incur lower project costs. In 2014, New York IDAs reported that only 32% of procurements used competitive bidding. In New York, 33 IDAs reported that they did not competitively select any contract procurements, while 10 did. Other government agencies did a bit better. Nonprofits defined as local authorities reported a 73% competitively selected procurement rate, while state authorities reported 65% and local authorities 57%. Quote, locally, the Rensselaer County IDA is among those that used a competitive selection process for its audit service contracts, resulting in a $203 cost per project for 60 projects. Compare that to the Albany County IDA, which did not use a competitive selection process and incurred a $393 cost per project for 15 projects, Hamilton writes. Read the full story in the Daily Mail. Matthew Hamilton in the Albany Times-Union reports that State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli wrote a strongly worded letter to the head of the Federal Department of Transportation, asking officials to increase oil train safety measures. Quote, any train accident involving crude oil or other hazardous materials creates the risk of significant human trauma and disruption to communities, DiNapoli wrote in a seven-page letter to USDOT Secretary Anthony Fox. Quote, the possibility of an accident on the scale of the Lac-Mégantic tragedy in Quebec is not only a significant hazard to New York residents and environmental resources, it is also a financial threat. A higher consequence incident would not only deplete the state's mechanism for funding cleanup of petroleum spills, but could also divert funding from other vital services, end quote. Currently, many oil trains race up and down alongside the Hudson River each day in the WGXC listening area. Dee Napoli, as comptroller, oversees the State Environmental Protection and Spill Compensation Fund, which holds up to $40 million for spill-related disasters. He says filings from CSX and Canadian Pacific leave, quote, open questions about the company's insurance coverage for large-scale accidents. Read the full story in the Albany Times-Union. The Mid-Hudson News Network reports in the Daily Freeman that a report issued by Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress shows the local value in urban farming. The study, quote, recognizes that the demand is high, even in smaller cities like Beacon and Hudson, says Pattern Research Associate Rebecca De La Cruz. Farmers markets, community gardens, and local supermarkets, quote, can make urban centers more desirable living and working spaces by eliminating food insecurity and addressing the prevalence of food deserts. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Bill Mahoney in Politico New York reports that Zephyr Teachout leads in fundraising among not just the other four candidates in the June 28, 19th congressional district primary, but she also leads among all 174 congressional candidates in the state. Teachout took in $530,732 in contributions from January through March, according to the Federal Elections Commission reports. That is well ahead of her Democratic opponent, Will Yandick, who raised $259,670. Republicans in the district did not raise more than either Democrat. John Faso raised $220,441. Andrew Heaney raised $217,990. Bob Bishop raised $21,580. Sitting Assemblymember Pete Lopez, who stuck his toe in and out of the race, raised $405. Teachout was boosted by Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who sent out multiple fundraising emails asking for $2.70 donations split between him and Teachout. The 10,657 Teachout donors included actor Mark Ruffalo and five members of the Soros family. Republicans Faso and Heaney, who've been in the race longer, have more cash on hand than either Democrat at this time. Read the full story in Politico New York. This has been the WGXC News Update. You can read these stories and more by visiting the newsroom at WGXC.org.
If you have a press release for All Together Now, send it to news at WGXC.org. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for today, Wednesday, the 27th day of April, 2016. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
First interview today is with local grower Chris Cashin from the farm at Miller's Crossing, talking about the current local weather conditions and how that's affecting farming with Kiernan Riley from the April 25th WGXC afternoon show.
Hello, good afternoon. Is this Mr.
Chris
Cashin? How you doing, bud?
I'm doing well, thank you. And you?
Doing pretty good. Hey, we were just hoping that you might be able to give us a little bit of an update as to what's happening on the ground there. How are you able to grow anything in desert conditions?
Well, irrigation is definitely necessary if you're going to be planting little seedlings in April. And we haven't had any rain, so they're pretty dry right now. We are scrambling to get some lettuce and broccoli in the ground today. And yeah, it's been, you know, kind of a get the irrigation system out early type of year. We pumped water last week, and actually, you know, to be quite honest, it's been kind of enjoyable because we haven't had to worry about working around the moisture and the wet field, the places that we can't get into when it's raining. So the positive side of being dry in the spring is you get a lot of field work done, a lot of plants in the ground, and then when it doesn't rain, when it's supposed to, you have to start having irrigation plans in the background.
Nice. So that's pretty handy for you, Chris, that in this way that you have this a good irrigation system on your farm, huh?
Yeah, we actually we are really lucky. We have an underground pipe that we installed several years ago, and Matt Herman and myself put in 4-inch pipe underground. Every spring, we thank God that we put that in the ground, and make, you know, we just have about 3,000-4,000 feet of pipe underground. So, as you can imagine, having to lay out pipe and install a hose system above ground every spring would get old.
It gets so old, right?
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Moving pipe is something that any vegetable grower will tell you is not really the best job or the most fun job to do.
Well, I got to, you know what, I got to apologize, Chris. I should back up for a second and actually introduce you. Chris Cashin, farmer and grower over at Miller's Crossing here in Claverack, New York, Columbia County, mostly doing vegetables, I believe it is, a very vibrant CSA. You're at the farmer's markets. Do you have animals still? Are you still doing some animal husbandry as well, Chris?
Yes, that's actually why I was late to call you.
What were you doing?
I was feeding the cows. They came home and they wanted to be fed.
So you've been working till the cows come home?
Yeah, literally. They came home and I fed them, and now I have to go to Little League baseball practice.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you coaching? Are you coaching or just watching?
Coaching.
Oh, awesome!
And watching.
Yeah,
hopefully.
No. Yeah. You can't watch. You gotta play.
Yeah.
That's the way to go. So we're totally. Not completely labor-free, but that pipe is all laid out in the ground already, and so we kind of have to do that spring, check over, make sure everything made it through the winter without cracking, and make sure you drained all your pump housings and your motors, and your pipe is, you know, got squirrels living in it and chipmunks, and we did all that last week in anticipation of this dry weather, because it, you know, it didn't look like it was going to rain, and it certainly paid off being ready because, you know, we had quite a bit of plants in the ground, and it was like, you know, 80-something degrees and planting on black plastic and felt like middle of the summer.
Yeah.
And let me just quickly ask you a non-technical question. Farming can be a group effort, and in your case, it's actually a family effort. I'm wondering how your wife, Katie, who farms with you, and your wonderful parents, Jim and Meg, are doing.
They're all doing well. They're My folks are without hot water as we speak. We're trying to figure out why their boiler's not working, but otherwise...
But they're doing well. They're doing great. They just can't take a shower.
Exactly. They're going up the road for a shower. But they're doing well, and Katie's very busy. We're homeschooling our kids, and she's doing that. She's also doing a lot of horse and pony stuff and helping out getting the greenhouse stuff in line and picking out neat varieties and, you know, doing things that she enjoys doing on the farm.
So you're saying that the kids are able to learn things from a farm?
Well, you know, it's funny. The business and the house, you know, there's a line there that we always try to keep just because the farm can become quite consuming, you know, and there's a point in the day when the kids are kind of sick of hearing about the farm and they want to talk about more important things like, you know, music and baseball and things like that. So they do help, and they're very aware and conscious just because they've been around it their whole life. But we haven't pressed them into full-time service yet. My oldest is 13, so we're kind of going slow and easy with that and trying to keep them optimistic and happy about the whole farming thing in general. as you know, farming can be intense, and we don't turn them off to it too much. So we're trying to keep it light for the kids.
Well, they're learning how to take care of animals. You said you still have the horses, you said?
Yeah. So we have chickens and horses and ponies and the cows and lots of dogs and cats. But, they actually are more involved than kind of almost than we notice, just because it's just a part of the life every day, chores. And got to feed them in the morning, feed them at night, check their water, put them out the pasture, ride them. So they're getting the responsibility lessons that go along with animals and pets and all that, as well as seeing where the hay comes from. You know, we make all of our own feed here on the farm. So, like I said, they're kind of absorbing their education through just being around it and growing up with it. And I think they know more about farming at their young age than I did it, you know, as a teenager. So that's nice. I mean, whether or not they end up being farmers is another story. We'll see. But in the meantime, they're certainly getting a full dose of it growing up.
Yeah, that's great, Chris. When you're saying what Katie does in the greenhouse, that's a lot of planting seedlings for perennials for summer sales that you do, that are all not just vegetable, but also you sell a lot of perennial flowers and annual flowers. Is that correct?
Hudson Farmers Market is an awesome market, and Hudson is a gardening town. There's a lot of people who have backyard gardens and, you know, patio stuff going on, and I'm always amazed at how many people who live in the, you know, within the boundaries of the city of Hudson who have big gardens, and, you know, they buy a plant from you in the spring, and then they come back. It's like reporting on their children. They tell us how their tomatoes are doing and how their pepper yield was and what size cabbage they grew, and so it's fun to kind of get to know people a little bit through their hobbies, and plants are always just feel good, you know. People come to the garden to get, you know, to get out of their house and do fun things. So it's nice to be supplying them with the things that make them happy.
So if I want to stick a bunch of pepper plants and some tomato plants in my backyard garden here in Hudson, for example, first of all, after I do my lead tests, how do I find your plants? Are you can we come to your farm? What's the best way to actually buy startup plants, and when, from you?
Yeah, well for starters, you know, obviously the Hudson Farmers Market every Saturday from 9 to 1 down at the DMV parking lot there is probably the easiest, quickest thing off the top of my head. But we also sell to area nurseries, you know, the Berry Farm in Chatham, and honestly, Food Co-op up in Albany, and, you know, all sorts of pond-side nurseries, you know, places that are selling plants to the public, so people can get our stuff through there. But we're also pretty excited to be working and preparing a farm stand at a farm in here in Quabert, and so out on Route 217, we're going to be opening hopefully in 2 to 3 weeks to the public. You know, both plants and produce and maple syrup and beef, all the things.
Oh, that's great! I was hoping you were going to get there. That's great.
Yeah.
Is that located on the old Runyon farm that you are now working?
Yes, it is. That's exactly where it is.
So on that big corner, as you get onto 217, heading towards Philmont from Hudson, you're pretty much right away. The first farm you come to, you used to have a bunch of dairy cows there. So that's now Miller's Crossing Vegetables going in those fields. What else besides vegetables are going in your fields and cover crops?
We are going to be planting day-neutral strawberries this year, and kind of an effort to have those essential items that you need to have at a farm stand to make people happy, you know, sweet corn and strawberries and tomatoes and all the things that people really get excited about, and we'll get them to stop their car and pull in. We're also, like I said, doing a lot of the cover crops. We're going to, you know, make straw and offer square bales, and, you know, all the things that we kind of have here we're going to try to figure out a way to offer it to the public if it's appropriate, if people have an interest in it. It's one of the exciting things about having a direct market stand is you can kind of, you know, try the different things out that you grow that maybe you enjoy, but you've never tried to bring to a market and sell, and you know, have a venue to offer it to the public.
You said something about also growing your own feed, which really fascinates me. Are you doing that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, pretty simple. We have a grass-fed herd of beef cows. So, you know, we're not doing grain, per se, for the animals. We're doing grain for the, you know, for the cover crops.
Gotcha.
And so pretty much hay and pasture are the main components of our, you know, feed for the animal system. But we're doing grains for cover crops, and you know, we can feed our chickens oats, but we don't grow corn and we don't grow soy, things like that. So it's another way to, you know, kind of, obviously we wouldn't want to be buying hay if we had the opportunity to make it, so you know, making the hay, and we sell a little bit of extra hay that we have. It works out pretty well.
Hey Chris, how was the maple season for you?
Obviously, as everyone was talking about, it was a really early season. We were tapping in the end of January, which is kind of unheard of. For the last several years, it's become a little bit more typical with these wild swings of weather we've had. But ironically, 2015 was one of the coldest seasons, and a lot of the challenges that we faced last year had to do with the fact that it was so darn cold, and things were frozen, and things didn't run so late because the trees were all frozen as well. So then you fast forward to 2016, and it was like complete opposite. Now we've had one day at the beginning of March, where we had sap coming out of the trees at 70 degrees, which the night before it had been 28. So we had a run for the sap there. And it was good sap. We were, you know, we were making syrup out of it, but it's a pretty sugar mineral rich solution that you start cooking with. And so when it gets warm like that and it sits, you really got to be careful about you know, things fermenting and starts kind of wreaking havoc on systems that, you know, maple syrup is designed to be done in during the cool weather.
Here come old Flat Top, he come groove.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines.
This is Tom Rowe with the radio news about radio waves. On April 25th, the Federal Communications Commission and Justice Department announced approval of Charter Communications' merger with Time Warner Cable and Bright House Networks, deals valued at $88 billion. The two internet service providers combined could control 70% of the nation's 25 megabits per second and up broadband subscriptions, Ars Technica reports. Last year's FCC net neutrality ruling considered internet service a public utility, and in this public utility, one company owns more than two-thirds of the market. The Justice Department only approved the merger with the prohibition that the combined company may not enter into anti-competitive deals with programmers that would keep shows and movies off streaming services such as Netflix and Hulu. The FCC says Charter agreed not to impose data caps on users for 7 years and must abide by the net neutrality rules, even if the rules are overturned in a federal appeals court case currently pending. Quote, the cumulative impact of these conditions will be to provide additional protection for new forms of video programming services offered over the internet, unquote, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said. Free Press President Craig Aaron disagreed. Quote, customers of the newly merged entity will be socked with higher prices as Charter attempts to pay off the nearly $27 billion debt load it took on to finance this deal, unquote, Aaron said. Quote, Charter and Comcast now have unprecedented control over our cable and internet connections. Their crushing monopoly power will mean fewer choices, higher prices, no accountability, and no competition, unquote. The new company will be the second largest broadband provider with 19.4 million broadband subscribers and the third largest video provider after Comcast and DirecTV with 17.3 million customers. This is Tom Rowe for Waveform Radio and WGXC.
It's Tuesday, April 26, 2016.
The Soviet version is this. One of the atomic reactors at the Chernobyl atomic power plant near the city of Kiev was damaged, and there is speculation in Moscow that people were injured and may have died.
30 years since the world's worst nuclear accident, new efforts to contain it.
The United States looks forward to formally joining this agreement this year.
Record number of nations sign the Paris Climate Agreement on Earth Day. Plus,
we can make an aeroplane with an unlimited endurance, an aeroplane that can fly forever.
Solar-powered plane goes halfway around the world.
All of those world records and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Coal has diminished as fracking has increased. People need their lights on. People also don't want their bills to go up, and that hurts poor people as well.
Did you ever notice how right-wingers only seem to give a damn about poor people when you take their coal away? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a lot of big world record news in today's Green News Report, it sounds like.
Yep, it certainly is. First up, this week marks the 30th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, the worst nuclear disaster in world history.
Which one is the best nuclear disaster?
On April 26th, 1986, human error plus a flawed reactor design led to an explosion and a nuclear core meltdown at the nuclear power plant in Chernobyl, Ukraine. Officially, 31 people died from radiation poisoning. In the depths of the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the news was greeted with suspicion. Here's ABC News anchor Peter Jennings 2 days after the accident.
Soviets may have been fairly quick to acknowledge the accident because evidence in the form of mild nuclear radiation had already reached beyond the Soviet borders to Scandinavia.
The region is still uninhabitable due to radiation. Fast forward to today, new construction is underway to replace the current deteriorating containment structure with a truly massive new dome to seal the damaged nuclear reactor and its radioactive fuel for 100 years. Of course, the site will require human monitoring for 3,000 years.
And, of course, we still have people, respected scientists today, who are calling for nuclear energy to replace fossil fuels. The 30th anniversary of Chernobyl is a good reminder, and I ain't convinced.
One good outcome, scientists say that within the uninhabited Chernobyl exclusion zone, wildlife populations like bears, birds, and wolves are flourishing in the absence of humans.
Yeah, but many of them have two heads and they glow in the dark.
Well, one scientist told National Geographic that that means that human populations have a bigger negative impact on animals than radiation. Meanwhile, 175 countries signed the Paris Climate Deal in New York City on Earth Day. That's a record for any United Nations agreement. All member nations unanimously agreed to cut global greenhouse gas emissions to keep global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. At the signing ceremony, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "Now the hard work really begins."
The new energy future, the efficiencies, the alternative resources, the clean options. None of what we have to achieve is beyond our capacity technologically. The only question is whether it is beyond our collective resolve.
The Paris Agreement takes effect when 55 countries representing 55% of global greenhouse gas emissions formally join it. The world's two biggest emitters, the U.S. and China, both have pledged to do so by the end of the year. President Obama will use existing executive authority, already commonly used in foreign agreements, to avoid triggering Senate review.
But that won't avoid a congressional lawsuit, I suspect, the way that they have filed suits against his executive actions. I suppose that could still be in the offing, even for this Paris climate agreement.
Oh, no doubt. But do note that current emissions pledges are not enough to make the 2 degrees Celsius target, but the Paris Agreement establishes the framework for moving forward. Meanwhile, in conjunction with the UN signing ceremony, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have launched an initiative to develop a global price on carbon to require polluters to pay for their pollution and impact on the climate.
That would be known as a carbon tax.
Or even cap and trade. But the big deal is it would be global. Finally, the world's first 100% solar-powered airplane, the Solar Impulse 2, has resumed its historic round-the-world voyage, safely landing in San Francisco on Saturday after a 3-day nonstop flight across the Pacific Ocean from Hawaii, powered only by the sun, including at night. According to pilot Bertrand Piccard, the demonstration flight is just the beginning.
Now it's a new era. Freedom is about being independent from fossil energy. The Wright brothers, they had no technology to transport passengers when they started. And some people were saying it's useless. And nevertheless, 66 years later, there were two men on the moon and airliners everywhere around the world.
The Solar Impulse 2 travels next to Phoenix and then New York City.
The pilot of the Solar Impulse 2 is named Captain Piccard.
Yes, he is.
For much more on that story and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
If you have a press release for All Together Now, send it to news@wgxc.org, and our crack community reporters will see if we can mention your news on the local airwaves on the collaborative 6 p.m. local radio news show, All Together Now.
Next, we talked to Karen Loeffler, the Valencia Volunteer Rescue Squad, who spoke with Holly Tanner and Justin Weaver April 27th on Something to Talk About on WGXC.
We have Karen Loeffler with us. Did I say your last name right, though, dear?
You did. Karen Loeffler.
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 Okay. Karen is with us. She's from Valencia, and I'm looking at her Facebook, and it had more stuff.
I'm in trouble now.
I know you work for, it was there. Where did it go? Karen is an EMS, right? You work in the rescue squad, Valencia Rescue Squad, and for Barnwell?
Actually, my career job is Barnwell Nursing Home.
Okay.
I've been there 31 years, but I volunteer with Valencia Fire Department. I've been a Class A firefighter for about 7, maybe 8 years. I'm not real sure. And I've been with Valencia Rescue for 12, I think.
Wow. Okay. Very good. And Karen's here to talk to us. You know, April is, seems like there's something going on every day almost now, National This Day or National That Day. And April was Donate Life Month, which you can still participate in going down to local DMV, 560 Warren Street. I can say that because it's my job.
You can. We've been schooled.
Yes,
we had training yesterday.
We know what we can say.
I
we
can't
say
anything, but you can say whatever you want.
I can. I'm special. But
I'll figure out a way around it.
during April, there was a weekend called Recruit New York, which is to try and get more people to sign up to be volunteer firefighters. And so Karen's here to talk to us about that and all things firefighting. So how did your weekend go? Did you recruit any volunteers?
We didn't get any recruits that we know of.
Yeah.
We had a few people stop through. We had another neighboring department that came over and hung out with us for a while. Niverville did.
Okay.
But we had a good time. You know, even if we don't get recruits, it's a brotherhood and sisterhood of everybody just getting together and showing what we do best.
Sharing stories and
You know, hanging out front. We had some kids that came over. We hooked up some rigging to a Stokes basket. Uh-huh. We're actually giving them rides in the Stokes basket.
Oh, cool.
What's a Stokes basket?
It's something that if you get somebody that gets hurt, you can put them in that. It'll support them, and you can get them either if they're down in a gully or down over a bank, you can pull them up and out of there.
Now, I want to know, when we were told that we're going to have you on, I was very I was intrigued, a volunteer female firefighter, and I don't know if I'm in the Stone Ages. Are there a lot of volunteer female firefighters, or is that a newer thing that you're seeing?
It's not new. Mm-hmm. There's definitely not enough female firefighters.
Right.
But there's more and more each year. I think actually had the first female fire chief.
Wow.
Melissa Eigenbrock from Red Rock.
Mm-hmm.
So we're
That's exciting.
We're coming a long ways.
Now you're a member of Alaysia, so are there other female
right
firefighters
now,
or are you
right there? Now I'm the only female firefighter. I
Woohoo.
I don't mind. I mean, I can hang with the best of them. And,
I bet you can.
And I don't like to be differentiated from female
right.
to male.
Which
we're all the same.
Yeah, that's a very good point that you make, Karen. Is it difficult to become a fire man or woman?
Like,
firefighter. What are some of the things of the...
Firefighter. See, we're learning.
Firefighter. I hate PC. Firefighter.
I was going to say fire person, so...
I'm a fire person.
Firefighter, yes.
Is it difficult to become... What are some of the steps if someone is interested? Because I'm assuming that you can take recruits all year.
We recruit year-round. We
and
don't
actually,
ever stop.
Talk a little bit about, I mean, why is it... So our most, I don't know if people understand this, that in most rural areas, it's different in urban areas, but in rural areas, the fire departments are volunteer. They're not paid staff. So it's extremely important if you ever have a fire, and that's why I'm coming back around to Melissa. Have you ever experienced, and it's a horrible thing, I hope you wouldn't, but a fire situation?
Yes, and I was actually going to ask her about this because I totally did the wrong thing. So I was cooking, and then I had a stovetop fire. And I was going to ask you what the best thing to do to put that fire out would be, because a lot of people would just throw water, but they know it's not water anymore. And then hitting it with a towel doesn't work from experience. So then I just opted to flail my arms and run out of the room screaming. And that didn't work either. So what would you suggest if anybody...
Put a lid on it if you can.
Are you talking about talking?
It.
Me talking? Or
Cover the pan that's on fire.
Put a lid on.
Don't pick it up and run with it, because if it's a grease fire,
yes.
It'll splatter.
If you're throwing
hot
grease, you're going to catch something else on fire.
Right. Okay.
And water spreads it as well, right?
Yeah.
Water
so don't throw water on a grease fire, please.
So
you want to try and smother it, is that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. What about baking soda? I heard about baking soda. Does that work?
It may. I'm not 100% sure on that, so I'm not going to say yes or no, but I know you take the air away from it and it's going to go
smother
out.
Smother it.
Yes.
Okay. So also, that's a good point. How many of us have fire extinguishers at home? I don't. Do you?
Yeah, fire extinguishers. No, I do. We have fire alarms.
You do. I know you do.
No
so
fire
now,
extinguisher.
Where does one get a fire extinguisher around here? I don't even know where to go.
Oh,
do they have that Walmart?
Hardware stores.
Yeah, hardware
probably
stores.
Probably Walmart.
Okay.
Yeah, has
so
everything.
Maybe everybody should.
See the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org for more information on anything you hear on All Together Now.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for April 27, 2016. I'm Veronica Carter. Making news today, no do-over in the Arizona primary after a judge's ruling. Groups in North Carolina want to overturn a judge's ruling upholding a voter ID law, and allergy season is hitting early in much of the U.S. Looking at the news headlines for today, some North Carolina groups upset with a federal judge's ruling that upholds a voter ID law are hoping to get that decision overturned.
state's Republican-led legislature put the law into place in 2013 that requires voters to show ID. Those opposed to it include civil rights organizations and churches. They say it discriminates against minorities that tend to vote for Democratic candidates. Some groups in North Carolina who are upset with a federal judge's ruling that upholds a voter ID law are hoping to get that decision overturned. The state's Republican-led legislature put the law into place in 2013 that requires voters to show ID. Groups opposed to it include civil rights organizations and churches that say it discriminates against minorities that tend to vote for Democratic candidates. There won't be a do-over for Arizona's presidential primary. A Maricopa County judge says testimony at the two-day hearing convinced him that a reduction in the number of polling places resulting in long lines of voters does not prove that there was an intention to deprive people of their vote, nor did it affect the outcome. A man from Tucson had sued, claiming many voters were denied their chance to vote and election results should be redone. The largest group of Oregon healthcare workers in more than two decades have approved a union contract. Eric Tegetoff has more.
On Monday evening, more than 1,100 caregivers at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center joined the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU Local 49, approving a three-year contract. Spencer Saxt is a certified nursing assistant and was on the bargaining team between Sacred Heart management and workers.
I think we came to a strong agreement in the end that still allows management to do what they need to do to run a hospital, but it also respects the work that the frontline caregivers are giving.
The workers will receive a pay increase of 21% over the three-year span of the contract, as well as pay incentives to work beyond 40 hours a week and more affordable family health care.
The Environmental Protection Agency has reconfirmed its initial claim that reducing emissions of mercury and other toxic substances would have enormous health benefits. Greg Stottlemyre reports.
That comes as no surprise to retired Berea resident Steve Wilkins, who grew up just outside of Wheeling, West Virginia, where coal was used to make steel.
I had asthma, and it wasn't for decades later that I realized that it was the coal ash that came from the blast furnaces, along with many homes heating with coal in that area.
Wilkins says he's become a conservationist in recent years, favoring a move toward cleaner energy solutions. The EPA estimates that nationwide, the new standards would have about $90 billion a year in health benefits, preventing up to 130,000 asthma attacks, 11,000 premature deaths, and 4,700 heart attacks annually.
Well, some good news for California. Reservoir levels are again being boosted by spring storm runoff. The State Water Project is upping allocations. Doug Carlson is a Department of Water Resources officer.
We fortunately have received quite a bit of rain in Northern California. The major reservoirs like Lake Shasta and Lake Oroville are now over 90% of capacity. They're filled up that much.
Water delivery estimates are now at 60% for the calendar year. The original State Water Project allocation was just 10%. Danger lurks in your home that you may not even be aware of. New study shows a 17% increase in calls to poison control centers across the country in the last couple of years because of kids eating laundry or dishwashing soap. Study co-author Henry Spiller says they looked at both laundry and dishwashing soaps.
Bright little 2 and 3 year olds running around their house. And these are very pretty, and they put them in their mouth and they kind of bite into it thinking it's, you know, perhaps candy. And it squirts into the back of their throat and they get sort of a blast of this.
In the 2 year study, Spiller says poison control centers got more than 22,000 calls because of children either eating or inhaling laundry pods or accidentally squirting the contents into their eyes. Spring is finally here. And so are tree pollen allergies. More from Tim Morrissey.
It's tree pollen this time of year that causes eye, nose, and throat misery for allergy sufferers. Dr. Mark Moss, an allergist with UW Health, says it's never easy to predict what kind of spring allergy season it will be.
The interesting part about this season is that it really did start incredibly early. We had a very mild winter, and the temperatures increased pretty rapidly in February. And that just led to an early pollen release from the trees.
Now that April has finally warmed up, Dr. Moss says he's seeing a lot of patients in clinic whose allergies are triggered by tree pollens. Allergists can prescribe medications to help with the symptoms, but allergy shots can help the body build resistance to pollens.
Do you know everything about your significant other? A survey of newlyweds by Experian found 40% of respondents said they did not know their spouse's credit score before getting married, although 9 in 10 said financial responsibility is an important attribute in a partner, and over 30% of them said their spouse's credit score eventually impacted their ability to get a home loan. Survey also showed 16% have secret financial accounts their spouse doesn't know about. You're up to date. I'm Veronica Carter for Public News Service. Member and listener supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Tom Rowe for WGXC with the local weather. Thursday morning, the low should be around 32, and Thursday should be mostly sunny with a high near 58. With a slight chance of showers after 2 a.m. Thursday night and into Friday, which should be partly sunny with a high near 56 and a low around 37. You're listening to 90.7 WGXC ACRA. This is Tom Rowe with the local community calendar. Anybody can add an event to the WGXC community calendar at WGXC.org. Just go to the calendar there and click on Add an Event at the top of the page and copy and paste the information about your community event. Soon, folks like me will read about it on the radio. Folks around the world will see it at WGXC.org. Thursday, April 28th, Coymans has a workshop meeting at 6 p.m. at the Coymans Town Hall in Ravenna. There's also a public meeting Thursday, April 28th, that the New York State Department of Transportation is holding with the towns of Claverick and Greenport about the replacement of the Route 9H bridge over at Taconic Creek. That's at 6:30 p.m. at the Columbia Green Community College. Also Thursday, April 28th, Ankrum has a public hearing. That's at the Ankrum Town Hall at 7:30 p.m. in Ankrum. Tashi Dorji is playing at the Spotty Dog Books and Ale on Saturday, April 30th. Here's the song of the day, Realms on High, from Tashi Dorji. Here's a song from Kitty Kelly, who's performing at Gavin's Irish Country Inn on April 30th in East Durham.
Summer's on its way, that means it's time to pack your bags, head for the hills. Here the world comes to a stop, nestled between those mountaintops. Catskill fever's taking care of bills. Music fills your days and dancing fills your nights. Stories from the other side, tradition burning bright. And if you ask me where I'm bound, I'm heading for the mountains to East Durham town. Through Way Street to 21, heading to the setting sun. You can feel the tension leave your bones. Clapping hands and dancing feet, friends and strangers pleased to meet. Catskill fever brings you close to home. Music fills your days and dancing fills your nights. Stories from the other side, tradition burning bright. If you ask me where I'm bound, I'm headed for the mountains to East Durham town. Music fills your days and dancing fills your nights.